You're listening to Earth Boots, and this is Ken Finn, and with me today I have James Murray White. We're going to be exploring some places, some people, and some issues that are both close to our hearts. So welcome to my kitchen, James.
Thank you, Ken. It's lovely to be here on this lovely, glorious day and this heat wave you're having here in Brighton, this lovely view and sounds outside. It's lovely to be back in. Are we in East Sussex or just Sussex?
We're in East Sussex.
East Sussex. Yeah, it's lovely to be in this part of the world. I'm based in Bristol these days and slightly dreading going back tonight. And I doubt we've had such a heat wave as you lucky folk here with your vineyards on the South Downs.
Yeah. So let's talk. We opened the show with some Bedouin music. So that's somewhere a bit further down the line in your journey. But where would you say that your personal journey started?
I reckon I'm really proud and happy that I grew up in the city of Cambridge, or just in a little village, actually on the outskirts of Cambridge, the village of Girton, because it kind of gave me a rural childhood of playing in streams and climbing trees and, you know, just a safe space of a village, and yet cycling into the centre of Cambridge just 5 miles away. And you know, when I went to sixth form, etc., that's what I did. I cycled every day into the centre of town. And of course, you know, Cambridge is an amazing resource of, you know, it was bookshops, music, and that's before you get into the kind of echelons of the university life. There was always parties. I remember an amazing all night Ken's cat has just come into the joined us. Hello, lovely. I'll talk about that later because I just sadly lost a cat, which is very heartbreaking. But Cambridge, all night cocktail bar, not a poncy place, but a place with black leather sofas where you could turn up at 12 o'clock at night and you know, just kind of be a student and just meet folk and, you know, drink heavily, but have a kind of an intellectual kind of time. So there was that, and I got involved in a lot of youth theatre stuff and developed my love of theatre. So that's where that all starts. So that's where my journey began, really. And I'm often back in Cambridge because my mum still lives there. I was back this week seeing her. And that's for further down the line. That's a project I'm working on now about Alzheimer's.
Okay, that'd be interesting. But you've been particularly interested with what you call threatened community, and I'm interested in that particular story and where that began. You were saying, you were talking about threatened communities, but
yeah,
you stated Ireland as it kicked off, which seemed unusual.
I think I found myself living in Ireland for various combination of circumstances. I spent a bit of time in living with a Tibetan Lama, so I think, and it was through the connection with him that I got to Mongolia, but also living on the west coast of Ireland, I became aware of the various kind of mini tribes or mini communities. I mean, certainly down in West Cork, there's a kind of mini community of so-called blow-ins that interact in a different way with the local community. And at the time, there was a certain amount of resentment. I also remember.
So what's a blow-in?
A blow-in is in modern Irish parlance, kind of someone who blows into the community doesn't have their roots there. You know, most, you know, Irish are really rooted, you know, whether they stay there or whether they've travelled and come back. And that's something, the big difference I found being a Brit. We kind of go all around the world and don't necessarily come back. You know, we find the good life wherever and that's it. But I found that a lot of the Irish diaspora were coming back. I mean, you know, there was the Irish American diaspora that would kind of come back for summer, or in Obama's case, and the other Kennedy and all the other American Clinton presidents that come back and find their roots. But, you know, a lot of Irish will come back after 20, 30 years working around the world, doing whatever, but their home is in Ireland, and they'll, you know, they'll either do up their ancestral home, or they'll build an American-style bungalow ranch thing nearby. And that really, I think that kicked off things for me, because that was a sense of community, because I was young at that time, and, you know, been left home for a number of years, and was, you know, free as a bird, and you know, suddenly seeing that. I remember one night very clearly, actually. I was staying in a friend's house in County Sligo, and I was writing a play at the time, and had the radio on in the background, and the local news had reports of a pitched battle going on between traveller folk and locals in an area around Lissadell House, which was associated with Yeats, beautiful part of the world, right on the Sligo coast, and travellers had just been very attracted to it because it was a lovely site, quite isolated, and yet there was so much antagonism that, for whatever reason, you know, there was a fight going on with local. I mean, we were talking about 200 people at each other with pitchforks, and I was like 20 miles up the road listening to this on the radio. I couldn't get my head around why it was happening, but I kind of wanted to know. So that kind of incident kind of stays with me as a, you know, as a big kind of bolt out of the blue. Hang on, there's a community within the community, and why aren't they getting on? So that, I think that, you know, that is part of the motivation. Is, you know, I've also been lucky to get opportunities to go to far-flung places. Like, as I say, I spent a year in Mongolia through the connection with the Tibetan Lama.
Okay, so how did that start?
He has a fascinating kind of history. He was the Tibetan candidate for the Panchen Lama. The Panchen Lama is like number two under the Dalai Lama. And this chap was the Tibetan candidate, but the Chinese, I think, or the Tibetan government, Ken's cat is not obeying his dad's commands here in the background.
He's getting fed.
Oh.
These things happen in the kitchen.
Anyway, so this, I made a good connection with Rinpoche, and he had partly grown up and studied in Mongolia, and he reconnected with his community there post the collapse of communism in the 90s, and the resurgence of Tibetan Buddhism there as the more dominant religion. So in 97, through him, I got the opportunity to go and stay in a little resurrected monastery in the centre of the capital city, Ulaanbaatar, and do that. I mean, again, back to Cambridge, one of the beauties of the city is that I went back to Cambridge for a month or two in advance of going, you know, to earn some money and stay at home, etc. But in Cambridge, you just tap into the resource, and there's a Mongolian studies department. For a month, I was able to learn Mongolian grammar and get some grounding in that amazing language. So when I got there, I was off to a bit of a flying start.
So tell us, you know, tell us about your experiences there.
One of the most extraordinary experiences of my life happened on a trip deep in the Gobi, where I was kind of the monastery I was staying at went every year to different parts of the desert. You know, it's one of the biggest countries in the world, you can imagine, to tell different communities about how Buddhism was spreading again, and the amount of monks and how well it was doing, and to get money. Let's be blunt about it, to get money and to be a religious presence in the community. And so they took me off on their annual tour. I can't remember Bayan, a lot of the names have gone, but we went to one community where they'd never seen a white man, so that was really special, perhaps more special in hindsight, because on the day, you know, kids particularly are pointing at me and poking at me and pulling your clothes. But it kind of opened my eyes to indigenous worldview, for instance. I mean, I eventually kind of broke a bit with Tibetan Buddhism because I felt it was just coming in to replace a void. I mean, there had been a kind of an annihilation of Tibetan monks or Tibetan Mongolian Buddhist monks in the 20s and 30s under the Russian imperialist regime. Is that right? Imperialist regime? I'm not. You know, thousands of monks had been killed and their monasteries had been destroyed. Anyway, so in the democracy of 1990 in Mongolia, Tibetan style Buddhism was resurgent. Mm. But I felt it was just kind of filling a gap. It is a country that's had a lot of impact and influence from shamanic practices, which is still quite strong in the more remote region of the north of Buryatia and Georgia and the underlying areas. I wish I had a map on me, Ken, of under Russia, the forest areas, and the Tiger, particularly the Tiger region. So kind of Buddhism seemed to me, you know, it's got great qualities, I wouldn't ever say that, but it seemed to be a little oppressive. I mean, it was also interesting being on the streets of Ulaanbaatar and seeing the white-shirted, pressed-shirt Christian missionaries come in, and that was perceived to be a huge threat as well.
Mm.
It was amazing to be there at that kind of really crucial time.
What year was this?
That was 97.
Okay.
I came back after a year and wanted to go back, but I wanted to go back through kind of work for an NGO for many reasons, because as an independent traveller based in a monastery, very limited resources for me, and I didn't feel that English teaching necessarily in the close confines of that small environment.
Mm.
The monks particularly weren't really interested. I was there to teach the monks, and yet the monks didn't see the purpose of learning English, really.
Sure. So what about the sights and sounds of that place? Tell us a little bit about that.
It stays with me forever. I remember going to a place, again, the name has forgotten, but has gone out of my memory, but it's said to be the site of where the Mongolian Humi sound comes from, riding on horseback.
What's the Mongolian Humi sound?
Humi sound. Well, I'm not going to try and demonstrate here.
But where does it come
from?
But
we can find some. It comes from this place, which is said to be the center of Mongolia, and it really is the sound of someone on horseback chasing their sheep, herding their sheep across a vast desert.
Mm.
It's the sound of the center of the body. It's the sound of the universe. And this
comes from the throat, from the belly,
from a combination of both. It comes from deep within your gut, basically.
Mm-hmm. And this is a deep resonant sound?
Deep resonant, and there's several tones, you know, that the masters, and I say masters, there's not many women, but they're said to be able to kind of channel several tones from the gut at several times.
Okay,
and
okay.
I can, you know, I've heard that.
So is there anywhere on the internet we can hear this sound? I haven't got any, obviously.
I'll send you some. We'll put some in the program. It's a gorgeous, I can't think of any websites. In fact, there was recently in London, there was a big 2-day symposium, some experts brought some people over, and there's one or two people here in the West. My good friend Mike Ormiston, big plug for Mike. He's a kind of Western master. Mike travels back to Mongolia every summer to train with a particular master, and Mike holds classes and concerts in London, right across the UK. So the sound of Humi has stayed with me, and as we discussed earlier, Ken, it's got that sound has got resonances with in other cultures, with the Inuit as the example that we gave. And also, there's some amazing crossover sounds. There's a band called Yat Ha, who are heavy metal with Mongolian Humi. They're really special. There's a few other Mongolian bands that have kind of started to make that crossover from just the traditional stuff to listening to Western sounds and blending it in, and
I was in India in Calcutta and shared an apartment. Well, we were in an apartment, and the lady who owned it said, "Oh, would you mind sharing with this guy?" And we went, "Of course not." No. And it was a big apartment, and he was Mongolian, and it was we start to talk, and he hadn't introduced himself, but he was kind of like, you know, I just get fed up with people talking about Genghis Khan, you know, and it's just like, you know, all they want to talk about is Genghis Khan, you know. And so I said, "Oh, yeah, okay, well, we won't talk about that." So I said, "But what's your name?" He went, "Oh, Genghis."
Yeah, totally. Ugh. I remember I once went into the president's yurt, and I don't like saying the word yurt because the Mongolians, it's a ger, G-E-R.
Okay.
But we know here what yurts are, so let's stick with that. Yurt is the Russian term. But you go into the, on a tour, and you go into the presidential yurt, and there's the chair where the president sits, and there's the chair where the visiting dignitary sit. But in between them, as big as this kitchen table, Ken, is this gold statue of Genghis Khan, that you would actually have to strain around to talk to you. So, you know, that just emphasizes the huge cultural significance. I think at the time I was there, it was getting stronger because of the low economic situation in the transition to democracy. You know, there was, you know, the Tugrug was really low. It was like 10,000 Tugrugs to £1, something like that. So there was definitely a resurgence of the cult of Genghis Khan. And as a result, there have been lots of books and films around that in the last couple of years. I think it's fascinating. I think Genghis Khan, you know, was clearly a barbarian. But, you know, this one person and successive Khans below him commanded 2/3 of the world's land surface.
It's mad, isn't it?
Just don't bear thinking about these days.
Yeah, so I thought we might just take a break and play some music. I can go and feed the cat, and then we'll come back to it. One of your favourite tracks from John Martin, and you can
the late great John.
Yeah, you can tell us a little bit more about him in a sec. My baby's been worried about my wife.
just one place for a man to be when he's worried about his life. I'm going home. Hey, 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 over there. Over the hill. Hey, 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 over the hill. Well, I'm going away to leave you. I'm going to leave you in disgrace. Got nothing in my favor. Rain in my face. I'm going.
You're listening to Earth Boots. I'm Ken Finn, and I'm talking to James Murray White. And yeah, that was a bit of John Martin, Over the Hill. And we dropped down the other side of the hill from Mongolia, and we're now we're in Inuit country. So,
God, hold on. Let me just try and think in my own head the kind of journey. I came back from Mongolia, and I felt very passionate about what I'd learned and what I'd seen, and the people I'd talked to, the amazing experiences I'd had in Ulaanbaatar, but right across the country in remote places too. So I spent a fair bit of time thinking about that and working on with others in the UK on Mongolian issues, trying to promote the culture, writing about the music, writing about the move to democracy and mm-hmm. how the Tibetan Buddhism was taking hold again. I went off to Edinburgh and did a master's in human ecology, which I thought would answer some of my questions. Another strand of what's been going on for me is I felt that I'd done a degree in drama and been an actor and playwright and was directed plays, but I realised after this time in Mongolia that I was completely arts, my head was in an art space. I'd no kind of sense of I'd been in this amazing desert. I wanted to actually understand a bit of geology. I wanted to understand a bit of earth science. I wanted to kind of think about that a bit more, biology, basic stuff. I didn't know basic stuff. I felt that before too long I'd stop myself going fully down one strand. So I took myself off to Edinburgh and did this interesting degree in human ecology, which went kind of some way to that. I think it kind of it made me look a bit more at anthropology, look at some key texts, Margaret Mead, etc., about tribes, about human communities, about far-flung communities, and later on think about our own communities, wherever we happen to be. But out of that came an opportunity to, well, actually, by that time I was living in the Middle East, but we'll talk about getting to Northwest Canada first. The opportunity to go to Nunavut, which is the capital of the Northwest Territories, which was created for the Inuit not that long ago. It's Nunavut is a kind of a, I have to say, it's kind of a sad city. It's a small place, but it's kind of built on oil and Western involvement in natural resources, exploitation of resources, and to some extent exploitation of the local indigenous community. I was there in the summertime. I did fly over icebergs, which was quite something, and saw polar bears from the plane. And also flew out to tiny Inuit communities. I saw a lot of alcoholism, unfortunately, which still persists. That's been the real blight of that, of Inuit communities who've just been poisoned really by alcohol and change to the diet. I met lovely people. I saw kind of a warm community, but still a very fragile community. It's a very proud community, and I can see that there is energy and passion within it to promote its indigenous culture, and I know that a lot of groups within it, for instance, have said the effects that they're feeling of climate change. They're further up from Nunavut. They're really getting hit by climate affecting sea levels and ice and snow, of course, in the colder times of the winter. But I just wanted to kind of dip my toe in and see, to some extent, a comparison with the communities I'd lived in Ireland and in Mongolia, and of course my own country in England and Scotland. I'm partly Scottish on my father's side, although there's no twinge of it. I'm very proud of my Murray heritage. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think down the line that's going to be a big project, writing and researching about the Murrays, because it's a fascinating lineage.
Okay.
But back to Nunavut.
So, what actually took you there?
What actually took me there? Just the motivation to coming out of the Mongolian experience. I'd read a lot about communities, and what was it that struck me about the Inuit? I think a sense of, again, that sense of coming out of colonial rule.
Mm.
Coming out of the history of exploitation, you know, some of me had been a bit fascinated by the kind of polar Scot, the Antarctic thing, and there the meeting with indigenous folk, and you know, I'm fascinated on that kind of liminal space between the white man coming for the first time, meeting the native, and what happens from then. I mean, one terrible example of the explorer Robert Peary kidnapped four Inuit, took them back to New York. That's an extraordinary book by Ken something or other. It's going to be filmed by what's the American actor?
So his name again was?
Robert Peary.
Yeah, and if you look at his Wikipedia link, it is just absolutely horrifying, this American explorer who went there, and the local people had one source of iron, which was a meteorite, to make their spearheads, and he took it back to America as an exhibit and deprived these people of their one source of spearheads. It was just like, oh my god,
and you know, we don't know this stuff. I mean, in that case, we do now, thankfully. But these people are in our education system, are up as heroes in our mythology in the West.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, that's not a genuine mythology if it's one of exploitation. I think we're living in a better time because the world is smaller and we've kind of been around it. I think that's debatable, but I don't think. I mean, you've got a lot of experience of that. I can see you're grimacing at me. But I don't... Yeah, that's... I'm backtracking a bit because I think that argument perhaps isn't so... But...
Okay, well, let's leave that...
Maybe it's done now in terms of big corporations going and grabbing what they want. But, yeah. But by and large, my reflection is that I saw a community... With some strength. That I've got subsequently after that trip, I bought a lot of books and materials by Inuit writers, you know, who are sociologists. There's a wonderful film called Atanarjuat.
Oh, amazing film!
I'm glad to find a fellow because I bang on about this film.
It's subtitled The Fast Runner. It's absolutely amazing film.
It's taken me several watches to really get under the skin of it because of that style of storytelling. Is so different from our Western kind of linear narrative. This happened to this day, and then we progress to this. That jumps back and forward from a current day to the ancestors, and you never. The first time I watched it, I never quite knew where I was. Mm. It took me a while to see that.
Mm.
And of course, you know, there's no clothes change, and there's no, you can't tell from the buildings because it takes place in an igloo.
Yeah, just to sort of recap, it's a film sort of told and portrayed by Inuit people, in and it just portrays real life as it, you know, may, I don't know if it still exists in that way, but it just such an amazing story.
Mm.
There was a similar film about Mongolia, wasn't there? Which is actually really is in this set in the current day, with the kind of child going off to school in there.
Is that the Cave of the Yellow Dog and the one about the camel? Yeah. They're lovely. The Cave of the Yellow Dog is the sequel, and the first one is the Weeping Camel. Mm. Again, they're kind of pastoral film
And the other one that I really loved, which is very similar, is Himalaya, which is set in Tibet, and it shows the movement, you know, this kind of tribal tensions about it's very beautiful,
amazing scenes of them moving the herd across great
stunning film, wonderful soundtrack
I think these examples, you know, have perhaps taken me to where I am now, kind of exploring film as a kind of medium.
Mm.
Certainly that film, The Fast Runner, and Zacharias Kunuk, his production company, Igloolook or something they're called, they've actually produced the third fully Inuit film funded through the Canadian Film Board about... It's a documentary about the impact of climate change on the Inuit culture. It's they've gone for a web-only release, which seems a bit strange because I don't think it's got that much publicity.
Mm.
I was
talking to Mark Anstis some while back. Scott. He did a reenactment for the race to the poles, and he played the British side, and he said it was a fantastic experience. He said it was horrible, but it was fantastic in you know, dragging a half ton wooden sledge with, you know, in tweeds and the like. But his experience was that they were trying to reenact on a terrain that completely changed, and that, you know, initially Scott had encountered, they had to climb over huge ice flows to actually get on with the beginning of the process, and actually that's gone now.
Right.
They had to go to Greenland to reenact it, and you know, I said to him, you know, what do you say to, you know, climate change deniers when you've seen it with your own eyes, and you know, I'm going to ask you the same question, you know. What do you say to people when they say, well, you know, it's all just a government ruse to raise green taxes? His response was he would like to punch them on the nose. So you have that option.
my response was just, you know, if you can encourage folk to get out see for themselves. I mean, I remember seeing Mark Linus give a talk in Cheltenham about his first book, where he's a man full of passionate vision for this, and for him it was his parents giving him a photograph of a glacier somewhere. It was in South America, and something took him back. I can't remember if it was work or just a personal holiday to that glacier 20 years later, and he told his parents, I'm going to go back to see this place. And you see, he shows you the photograph he took compared with that one, and the thing is non-existent. There's a trickle left. I think part of my fascination, more than fascination, is kind of sad exploration, is a direct impact on communities. I won't say that climate change and environmental impact is my main focus. I think that's more human interaction with indigenous communities or Western, you know, where how indigenous communities hold on to their character and hold on to their kind of belief systems, and how much that's diluted. I mean, I'm fascinated, from a very personal point of view, because I wonder what my own community's beliefs and rituals are. I think they were very limited. I don't really know what they are, but I think by exploring other cultures is bringing me back to something. It made me think earlier here in East Sussex. I picked up a lovely old paperback recently, written by someone of the Copper family. Have you come across this? I heard of the Copper family a couple of years ago when I saw Billy Bragg in the Imagine Village play, and some of the Copper family, the younger members, were singing some songs of the Downs and East Sussex. You've come across them. And one of their, I think perhaps their great grandfather,
just outside Lewis.
Yeah. I wish I'd brought it with me, actually, and trod some of those paths and go to some of the village. But this lovely book, again, I'll remember what it's called. I'll send you the title, Ken. But it's a year in the life of this village, and it's tilling the soil and what the agriculture work is of that season, and
the songs are actually, although you know it was a hard life, there's actually a joy and a love of the country.
It was a really hard life, but it was bolstered by the community, by the close bonds, and you know, everyone was in and out of each other's kitchen, and you know, I'm sure it was 8 to 10 to a tiny little labourer's cottage, and you know, there was a certain amount of serfdom working on the estate. You know, for the lord and lady, but there was a sense of community, a sense of belonging to that place, and you know, the Copper family and Billy Bragg and the Imagine Village project is all about that kind of change in local communities, as specifically in the South Downs, how Sainsbury's is built and how a bit of green belt land. I see that for myself in Cambridge growing up. In the 50 miles between Cambridge and London, you know, the Stansted, but there were green fields either side of that, you know, and now I see Cambridge is going to be a suburb of London one of these days, concreted over and with new developments all around the north edge of the city, where my mum lives. She moved onto the edge of the city after I left home out of the village, but that's all gone now. They've actually built up to the motorway. You know, all the fields I used to play with.
It's interesting we have that. You know, currently out there is a debate on planning, and you know, and how you know, the government is hoping to encourage more building, and it strikes me that there's. That I don't know whether this is a, you know, right thinking or not, but we've in the past used space much more efficiently, you know, and you know, you were just talking about, you know, how many people were living in a house, you know, and in my childhood, you know, we grew up in a small house, but it was full of people, and somehow, you know, we. I'm not quite sure why we have this feeling that we have to have so much more space around us. We don't want to get on a bus because we want to be on our own in a car. You know, we get on a train and we put a bag on the seat next to us because we don't want anyone sitting next to us. You know, we want more space. We want more personal space. And you know, just as it's becoming more unacceptable to perhaps have two cars. Or you know, and to consume more, you know. I wonder whether it's actually, you know, there might be an argument to say that actually, you know, we should be encouraging people to share more of their space rather than have more space, you know. And actually, you know, that life isn't necessarily fuller for having more space. It's actually just emptier, you know, because it's, you know, we don't have those experiences. We're somehow frightened of contact. And when you know, those experiences of living, you know, just staying in villages, or, you know, in certainly for me in northern Cambodia, and, you know, places, you know, people have very minimal personal space, but there's a great deal of joy, you know, going down to wash. Now, I mean, one of my experiences of going to wash, and, you know, coming back from a dusty day, you know, in the jungle, hot and sweaty, and basically the place to wash was down at the communal sort of tap, you know, and we were all there, and just this moment of, you know, being a bit
washing together. That's
self-conscious.
How far away from washing together are we these days?
It could be, but, you know, but it was actually, you know, we soaked up and laughed, and, you know, and of course being the, you know, the white person in the midst of all, you know, midst of all these people, it's certainly a centre of attention. But it was so much fun, you know. And I thought, well, I could have been in a shower on my own. And,
I don't think, I mean, that aloneness that we create, I don't think we use it well, do we? We're pushing others away, but we're going off, you know, back to our one-person flat. We're existing in the day alone. We're not filling our head necessarily with peaceful, meditative reflection, are we? We're you know, I don't want you in my space because I don't know you. I don't know what you could do to me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I feel a bit of that tension because I spent some time exploring Buddhism and, you know, nearly became a monk and thought about the solitariness and how that solitariness and meditative life would kind of feed it a compassion, developing a compassion and altruism. And I do love a bit of solitariness. I'm a social animal. You know, we need people. We need that interaction. We need to know when the boundary is, and we need to know when we're given enough and our energy is depleted, and how to regroup and stuff. But finding that balance, I think, I mean, we hear it's said quite a lot these days, but I think we're out of balance.
Certainly
in the UK.
And a place that sort of seems to be out of balance for a long, long time has been, you know, Jerusalem and Israel and Palestine. You know, that whole area continues to be centre of news. And you went there and spent some time.
I lived in Jerusalem for 5 years, wholly due to the fact that I'd met my partner here in the UK. She was over on a writing course, and we got together. I kind of persuaded Tanya to come, and she says that she was testing me out by coming out and living here for a year. but after that, I knew that she would want to go back. So I lived in Jerusalem with her for 5 years. We came back 2 years ago, two and a bit years ago. It's still the place that deeply resonates with me in many aspects. Even though I try to put it out, it's actually been quite hard adjusting to coming back to the UK because of, you know, what I saw there and the environment with the political tensions, but also, you know, everyday stuff, the heat. Yes, I miss the heat, but seeing maybe 5 days of rain over 5 years is kind of nuts.
Wow.
40, you know, my particular thing was working with the Bedouin in the Negev Desert, you know, 40 degree heat midsummer. I mean, there were days that I, you know, had filming days, interviews days lined up, but, you know, I knew I couldn't go down in the, you know, the 2.5 hours drive from Jerusalem or the bus or even the train. You know, I just had to postpone them because it was a question of driving there in a newish air conditioned car. I couldn't get out of the car to go into that tent or room because, you know, the heat would have just floored me. It did floor me a lot. but over and above my kind of responses to it, my passion was, you know, I knew when I would be living there that I would gravitate to the Bedouin. I mean, this romantic notion of Bedouin, you know, we've got Lawrence of Arabia kind of mentality.
Sure.
And you know, that all took place around there, and Jordan and Egypt. But what condition are the Bedouin of Israel in? Well, they are a tribe apart. They're a tribe apart because they're kind of cut off due to the necessity of Israel having very tight borders. They kind of, sure, they have relatives in Jordan, Egypt. You know, these big tribal families, I'm talking about thousands and thousands of members, super tribes they're called, with very small tribal families within that connection. And they're really in a strange place, being citizens of Israel, and yet holding on to their identity as Bedouin. You know, in a similar way to the Inuit I discussed and the Mongols. But the Israeli Bedouin situation is different in that they are adapting to modern life and yet finding it so hard to hold on to that identity. And, you know, more than a tourist identity, there are one or two kind of Bedouin tourist camps you can go to.
Hmm.
Actually, today I've got one bit of good news. I can tell you lots of negative stuff about the situation, but today I can tell you that a researcher at Ben Gurion University, which is the university in the desert town of Beersheva, Ali and Al-Qanawi, who's a very dynamic academic, the first Bedouin, I think, to become a professor, very good man, very strong leader in his community, who's really tried to promote peace and cohesiveness in the Bedouin community. He was awarded today a grant of £700,000 to bring together peace activists across Israel to tighten the community.
Hmm.
So, Alian, congratulations to that. He's a dynamic man. I interviewed him several times and have links with him, so I hope to support that and promote his work, and good luck to you at this troubled time.
Mm, that's good news. I'm interested in what you were saying earlier about you know, there's a media story that gets told about the troubles there, about the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and you say that, but there's possibly another story that's not really told. And how would you describe that story?
There is an underlying narrative of dialogue going on in that region. It's a narrative of ordinary folk talking to each other. It's the narrative of people who've just had enough of the meta narrative of conflict and pain and not understanding the other. It's people that whose first response is to say, "You're different to me. That interests me."
Mm.
You know, I want to learn from your differences. Perhaps you want to learn my differences. Let's see what it's all about. I mean, I jokingly say that, you know, there's enough common factors there between Jews and Arabs. Hummus is one good example. And fantastic food. I mean, that really could, you know, we could in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv, we could go to 50 hummus or falafel stands, and they'd all taste different, and we could spend hours, you know, seeing, as we can here.
Mm,
as well.
Yeah, of course.
But you know, that's a culture where the heat predominantly develops so much passion. I mean, the driving, for instance, is you know, oh, I can't tell you about how chronic the driving is. But back to the thing, I mean, there are a lot of people and there are a lot of groups and they're activists and they're just ordinary folk talking to each other. I mean, another example off the top of my head is Slim for Peace. That's the title of a documentary film about a group of women brought together by a young Israeli woman who are slimming. And the whole ethos of the program is that they're from all sectors of society. There are some Palestinian women, and part of the thing in the film is how difficult it is for them to get into to Jerusalem, but on occasion they can. And some wonderful Bedouin women who I know, Amal Al-Sana, and settler women. And they come together, or I'm not sure where the program is now, but they came together monthly in Jerusalem to discuss how their slimming was going and to meet the other. It's, you know, it's a lovely, simple story. Mm. And of course, over the course of the 6 month course or whatever, you know, that they, if they don't become friends and they're not, you know, bosom buddies outside the course, they at least have gone on a little journey to understand and see and move a bit closer to the other. I mean, there are several groups. There's one of the groups I really support and think are amazing are called Breaking the Silence. Hebrew, I think it's Shomrom Stichim. Apologies if there's any Hebrew listeners out there. But they're ex-soldiers, principally, who were stationed and fought in Hebron. Hebron is a... I might be shot for saying this, but it's a godless place because of the hatred and the violence in that city. Mm. But these ex-soldiers say, enough's enough. We don't want to stand here in these checkpoints pointing guns at these Palestinian citizens every day. We don't like what the settlers are doing either. Basically, they're there to protect a tiny amount of settlers in the very centre of this ancient city, you could say ancient Arab city, ancient Jewish city, ancient mixed city, really. So they say, enough's enough. We're actually going to take people, we're going to first of all resign from our duties in the IDF, and in some cases have been in prison for that. And we're going to actually take people in, mainly tourists, but anyone who wants to go in, to see the situation on the ground. And they fostered relationships with good thinking settlers. You know, I definitely don't want to tar all settlers right wing fascists, although a lot of them are, and, you know, good thinking Arabs. You know, there's members of the Arab community. I mean, there's extremists on both sides, but this organization, for one, is really trying to get in the middle ground and open it up a little by bringing in dialogue, and they do powerful stuff. They need a lot more international support. I mean, they take a lot of Westerners in, they take a lot of diplomats in, so slowly the message is getting across. There's another group there, it's all coming to me now, they're called Comet ME, and they're a group of Israeli green activists who go into small isolated Palestinian agricultural communities, mainly in the South Hebron Hills, but I suppose, you know, I'm sure they would go wherever they can or wherever they're invited, and they build solar power installations, wind pumps, etc. You know, they often get intimidated by settlers on the outposts, but they do great stuff.
This kind of encouraging end to our talk, as we're fast running out of time.
I could go on for hours. Well, you started me off, Ken.
I'm sure we could go on for hours, and we probably would in the car later on. But just the usual stuff of, like, you know, if people are interested in more, you know, maybe you could point them to some resources. How would they contact you?
I've got a website which is www.sky-larking.com, which is a little old and a little rusty. It's got some of my journalism, some of my little film clips, quite a lot of Bedouin stuff up there. but it's got quite a page of links, and I'll review that in the next day or two and put some more up. You can contact me if there's anything I've said today that fascinates anyone and you want to know a bit more about that. I'd very much welcome a dialogue, and I can tell you more. And I'm at james@skylarking.com. And you know, please, if anyone's got stuff they want to tell me about, particularly about what's going on here, because I'm trying to stay, I live in Bristol with my partner, and I'm trying to stay grounded and get rooted back in this soil for a bit. So I welcome being told what's going on as well.
Cool. And talking about being rooted here, we were also talking about some other music that you were going to send me to play out on, and was that the Inuit?
If we started the show with some Bedouin stuff, yeah, we'll finish with some Inuit stuff. I've got beautiful piece track somewhere of was it to do with the Bedouin stuff is music around coffee grinding and roasting, and also from spinning and weaving. But the Inuit stuff is around a group of women. I'm not sure if it's exclusively women, but I think it's salting and curing some fish,
mm-hmm,
and a song that they sing around this. It was not recorded by me at all. I think it's from the 20s, a French anthropologist.
Okay.
But it's a song of work. It's and nice way to end the show. It's a kind of song of work and community.
We like that. Okay, well thanks for joining us, James Murray White, and
thank you, Ken. Lovely to be here.
Yeah, and I'll be back sometime soon, but look out for me on ken-finn.com, and there'll be links to some of the previous shows, and I'm sure James pop up this as a podcast on his website, so if you want to listen again, you can catch it there. Thanks for joining us. Bye.
Thank you. Gung miuta nedluk miuta pengnuktuk miuta aliva minua ungawa minua pirtuk teka minua nate rovia kita ima temik tahu tunggilanga ini konak tumir pinuk temik panggilanga gat kigalanga mat kabaligalanga ni tegatigalanga tegat ibat tegat tegat tenedek. Ini galanga ga, tiki galanga mat. Ika lu galanga ni, tiki galanga tu mi. Tengah tajuk kat tu lu dek.